Welcome to the DC KinCare Alliance podcast. This is Marla Spindell, Executive Director of DC KinCare Alliance. I'm joined with my colleague, Stephanie McClellan, and we are still speaking with our special guest, Christian Green. This is part two of our interview with Christian, and we will jump in right where we left off with respect to an independent ombudsperson, the need for that in the district at this time, comparing that to what other jurisdictions may be doing. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
Well, and it's not like it's outrageous to look to an outside authority to investigate child welfare. Lots of other states have either an ombudsperson or an office of the inspector general to do it. I'm thinking in particular of like the Office of the Inspector General for Illinois or for Nebraska. I think oversight, when you're talking about something so serious as life and death of a child, is not an unreasonable thing to be looking at.
No, I think it's definitely reasonable, but I also think DC is very small and power and control over investigatory functions is at the attention of many parties. So it can be highly contested. And I think DC's child welfare system has kind of its own trauma system to the workforce, given court oversight and some poor decisions that have been made public over the years regarding child fatalities or missing children. And what happens is the direct line ends up being blamed for often things that are directives at top. And I think there's a concern when the workforce is a little concerned that, oh, an ombudsman is going to try to hold me accountable for a decision that I didn't even make, which then it becomes important for the ombudsman to have the correct education and history to be able to do the investigation. And then you have leadership. Well, you know, I know how to run my organization. I don't need you to tell me how to do it. See, we just got, or we're getting out a receivership and we're successful and please stop questioning us. And so I think there's so many layers of resistance that even as ombuds, it took me quite some time to get the buy-in from the front line, really saying to them, listen, I really want to know what your clinical assessment is because I want to support you. And then I'd go to leadership and say, listen, this is what I'm hearing from your frontline. I'd give them my recommendations. And they would say, that's not true, this, that, the other. And I would just say, you know, I'm only echoing the ideas of your frontline staff. This is really your staff speaking to me. It wasn't my idea. It really is what they're saying. And so, you know, even just hearing your workforce can be really problematic when you feel like you have these oversights. The ombudsman has a very clear perspective on, I'm dealing with a constituent that brought a grievance. I'm dealing with a parent. I'm dealing with a child who says their rights were violated. And I need to investigate that rather than, why are your numbers this way?
So where can a child or parent go if they think the agency did them wrong at this point?
There is the ombudsman internally. That ombudsman has very limited powers. The parent could go to the Office of Inspector General, but the Inspector General is not very well versed on child welfare and might not even take up the grievance. They could go to the court monitor, but as we know, that's kind of ending, and the court monitor is very clear on what their measures are. They could try to go to DC City Council and waive confidentiality, but you have to be the right person to waive the confidentiality. You could go to the DC auditor, but the DC auditor really deals with audits of whether or not laws are enforced and don't really have the power to do individual investigations. So the answer is there is no one in the District of Columbia enforcing children's rights currently.
Wow, that's pretty depressing. And you also talked about the social work workforce and that they were coming to you at a certain point when you were there. Who can they go to when they think something's not going right within the agency? Is there an open line of communication for people to express any concerns or differences of opinion on policy or practice?
In theory, they're supposed to go to their chain of command. I don't believe CFSA has updated their whistleblower handout or administrative issuance. At the time that I was there, the phone number wasn't working, and I don't think they have somebody assigned to provide guidance on that. They could go to their social work board, but the social work board doesn't really have the right to get involved other than someone violating their licensure, but usually the people that are being complained on don't have a licensure in the District of Columbia at all, regardless if it's social work or not. They have the union, but the union only protects frontline workers. So if you, as a supervisor, which I was many times, was trying to support my social worker and ran into directives, you're not protected by the union. So it can feel kind of overwhelming as a worker because it's very difficult to figure out where you can go and what you can say to whom. At the point in time I was there, the whistleblower administrative issuance indicated that a person that believed there were violations of law or practice could go to the Office of Inspector General. I believe that to still be the case, there's clear whistleblower law in the District of Columbia that allows you to go to D.C. City Council, any investigatory entity, for instance, the D.C. Auditor, D.C. City Council, the Office Inspector General, the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability, or the Court Monitor. But each of those have their own. You could also do EEO, Equal Opportunity, and Human Rights Campaign, but that's distinctly different than a lot of things that we're talking about as violation of children's rights. So each of those have their own kind of investigative purview. And once again, you run into the problem that none of them really have the correct investigatory powers to deal with child welfare and the inherent confidentiality issues that come with child welfare.
So what if you're a social worker whose clinical decision was overruled and you're really worried about this family and you go up the chain of command and make your views very well known? How would that be taken in by the chain of command? Is there an open line of communication, open door policy, listen to other people's views? How does that work?
It depends on who your supervisor is. There are some really wonderful supervisors who will support you and advocate for you or tell you this isn't going to be received very well. But there's always a joke at CFSA regarding legal terminology is termination without cause, but inside it's called being walked out. And so, for instance, I was one of those individuals who was terminated without cause, and essentially the moment you're told you're walked out of the building and placed on administrative leave, and all of your access to email, the system, your phone, everything, your badge, everything is removed, even though technically you did nothing wrong. You're on administrative leave for 15 business days because it was a termination without cause. So that's a quite frequent experience within the child welfare community, and typically those things happen on a Friday. So at the end of a pay period is usually when they attempt to walk you out. And then when those things happen, there's always a rumor mill of what really happened and who did they tick off or what did they say, what did they do. You can always tell when it's an ask-a-tell. So, for instance, it's essentially when somebody was confronted with a termination without cause but given the option to resign.
And you saw social workers terminated without cause for raising concerns about child welfare issues?
I saw it throughout the administration. So it could be a social worker, it could be an administrator. Basically, you know, there were some terminations without cause that really they just didn't want a fight of with cause. And so there were some times where you're like, oh, okay, I kind of understand what was going on there. But most often, the termination without cause is because someone has taken a stance that is controversial or made some type of recommendation. So I've seen it throughout the chain of command. Often it was the clinicians that were terminated without cause, and often there was something in dispute at the time the termination came about. I know for me, my termination without cause highly coordinated with the agency not releasing the 2016 foster youth Amendment Act legislatively required Trin report to DC City Council on the public. And I was making recommendations in that report that showed violations of law or violations of children's rights, which in the district, children's rights are for foster children written into the DC municipal regulations. And so I refused to remove actual violations or actual findings that led to trends in child welfare from the report. And my last communication with leadership was saying that we really need to make the ombudsman in adherence with the legislation and standardize and do what the legislation required that the mechanism to investigate rights violations was supposed to do. That was my last communication with leadership, and it went dead silent for about 2 weeks, and then I was terminated without cause. So I've seen it for a variety of reasons. Yeah, I've seen it for a variety of reasons.
So just in case our listeners are interested, if you want to know about CFSA's whistleblower protection, you can go to cfsa.dc.gov/publication/AI-whistleblower-protection-act. And there is a link to an administrative issuance dated October 3rd, 2008. And in that administrative issuance, there is a number that employees can call if they feel like they've observed government misconduct within CFSA. And the number is 202-727-2061. And if you call that number, which I just did, you get an automated message that says Cisco Unity Messaging System. And if you don't know the extension you want to dial, you can go to an operator, but then it says the operator isn't available. And then you can just leave a message in a general mailbox. So it's pretty clear that that number is not in working order. So that's the extent of the whistleblower protection.
Yeah, at the time I was there, it linked to it was a number that people used to call in to see if, like, the weather was impeding whether or not you went to work. It was a recorded message.
Well, it's good to know they take that seriously.
Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about COVID and the pandemic and the public health emergency and how that may be impacting abuse and neglect, what you know as an expert about how things like that could impact abuse and neglect, and what we're seeing as far as reporting of abuse and neglect in DC, and any concerns you have about what might be happening in children's homes that we may not know about.
And I think COVID is a really difficult time, not only for the children in DC, but the social workers, because I've heard many social workers be exposed or have COVID. I think there was even some articles about getting PPEs early enough. But you essentially have a dynamic where our mandated reporters, who are usually service providers, teachers, social workers, things of that nature, aren't having the same daily contact. So the call number has gone down, but the gravity of the call has gone up, because by the time the abuse or neglect is seen, it's usually more severe. So I think it's a really difficult time for everyone. I can't say that the administration is doing it correctly, but I can say, knowing social workers who are going out, they're trying their darndest to adhere to assessment of safety. They really are doing a lot of brave work in this very uncertain time. And I don't know if they're truly getting all of the support they really need, which is hard. I do know that if they feel like they've been exposed, the agency has been real quick to allow them to be on isolation. I also know that they are primarily working from home, so that's one kind of caveat. The agency has been very much like, you don't really need to come into the office except for very essential things. So I think that's a positive thing, but I think that's just following what's happening across the nation currently. But with child welfare, obviously, there's much more difficulty addressing some of those that impacts child welfare, no matter how you look at it, that has an impact on child welfare, just because you don't have the mandated reporters the same way.
So one of the options when you are looking at the results of investigations by disposition is the worst option possible, a child fatality. It's something we talked about a little bit earlier, but specifically with regard to how COVID and fewer eyes being on these children who are at risk, like teachers and doctors not seeing these children, what impact do you think that is having on child fatality? And what do you think CFSA is doing about it, and what do you think they should do about it?
I think this is the time that it is extremely critical to listen to your clinicians. One, you have so few eyes on those children right now that you have to support your clinicians because they're the only ones seeing them. You don't have the same support systems in place. You don't have as many mandated reporters to contribute to the report as previous. So what I would say, and I don't really know if I have an excellent gauge on what's happening right now when it comes to directives, right? But what I would say is that in order to protect children during this time, we have to support our clinicians who are in the field and bearing witness, because they are going to have the most information, most credible information, and they are already putting themselves at risk in order to make that assessment on behalf of us as constituents, right? Like, we're a community. So I think if we're supporting our clinicians, that is the first step in the right direction. And then following protocol for anything that meets the criteria, whether it be a medical, legal, or a forensic interview, I think it can be quite dangerous during this time to make safety plans that are not clearly defined, because what you'll find is that they're going to be extremely hard to enforce. The parties that help enforce it are typically mandated reporters. And so if you're making a safety plan that really doesn't adhere to true safety, you're putting the child at risk. So we've talked about it before amongst us, not necessarily during this call, but illegal third-party placements when you're making safety plans with people who have no legal rights to protect the child. Those are some of the pieces of the puzzle that can lead to uncertain, unsafe, and risky situations, and potentially fatalities for children.
Can you explain a little bit more about what a safety plan is and when that may be implemented?
From a clinical point of view, the assessment of safety is immediate safety concerns, and you have to parse out risks. So as a clinician, you're determining this is an immediate safety concern, and so I need to plan around that. And when I'm making that plan, my plan legally has to be with someone who has legal right, so a biological parent or a legal custodian. And that person that I'm making the safety plan with has to be safe to plan with. And so if that individual is not safe to plan with, then I need to try to find the other parental figure or any other legal custodian to make a safety plan with them. Technically, if that party is unsafe to make a plan with, for instance, they just sexually abuse their child, or they're currently under the influence of drugs or alcohol, or having a mental health crisis, then I shouldn't be making a safety plan with them because they're not safe to make that with. A safety plan should be short term. It should be used for the purpose of putting in other services to mitigate the safety concern, and it should look at the safety of the child first. So a true safety plan would mean, say I'm dealing with a teen and the parent have gotten into a conflict. The parent is just overwhelmed and made threats. Well, I'm going to beat you if you say this again. If I go in there, I don't really want to conduct a removal. I want to make the family healthier. So I'm going to say, listen, is there somewhere where this teen can stay, say, the weekend, like grandma, grandpa? Are you in agreement with everyone taking a break when I get back to the office on Monday? I'm going to connect you up with some family therapy. We're going to talk about how to mitigate some of these concerns. I know they're skipping school, so maybe we'll start a PINS referral, which is through the courts to hold the child accountable for attending school, obviously in non-COVID times. And that's what a safety plan looks like. The current wave of safety plans that is dangerous is when I'm making a safety plan with someone who's not really safe to make one with, and as the state, I have a duty to protect, and if the child's not safe, I have the duty to remove. When I assign a removal responsibility to someone who has no authority or legal authority to make decisions on behalf of that child, that places that child in danger. So, for instance, the parent's under the influence of something or having a mental health breakdown, but they say, hey, grandma's around the corner. So I, as a state, knowing the parent is unsafe to plan with, place the child with grandma, which is a placing decision, which I only have the authority to do if it's a foster home. But if I place the child with grandma and sign a safety plan saying grandma's going to go to the court and apply for custody and enroll the child in school, first of all, custody courts take much longer to go through. I have no right to give the grandparent the ability to change schools or consent to medical. And then in theory, that unsafe parent, because there's no legal right for grandma to keep that child, the unsafe parent can go get the child and return to their home, and the child would be in the same unsafe environment as before. And especially if I'm using a safety plan to unsubstantiate the parent or negate my responsibility to open a case and provide services, that means that safety plan is a false sense of safety, that child can be put in danger during this period of time. And then I, as state, have said, I don't have any responsibility to follow up because I made the safety plan, I closed the investigation as unfounded, and there is no open case. You leave the child in that very unsafe environment, and those unsafe environments tend to escalate. And those are the ones that are concerning for child fatalities in the end.
So when they have the child go with a grandparent informally and they don't actually do the removal proceeding and they tell them to file for custody, or maybe they don't even tell them to do that, how is that grandparent able to get services for the child? Like if they have to go to the doctor, get them enrolled in school, how does all that happen when that person doesn't have the authority?
The most direct answer is it doesn't. That's often when I would get complaints as the ombudsman. This child's in my home. I don't have the right to consent to medical. The school won't let me do this. I don't know how to do X, Y, and Z. So those issues become extremely highlighted and prevalent. And then the state will say, well, there's no immediate safety concern right now, so we don't need to reopen the investigation. Or if you, as the safety plan, drop the child off at the agency, we're going to substantiate you for unwilling caretaker. Or, for instance, you go to the court, you get custody, but you have no services for the child. The child has experienced trauma due to abuse and neglect, and now you're at your wit's end and you want to turn the child back over to the parent, but now you're the legal custodian and you're looking at your name on the child protective registry or a court case against you. And we have to remember that child welfare laws are written to determine whether the child was abused or neglected, not about the perpetrator. We have a system in place that looks at coding the perpetrator's name, so we have a child protective registry, but really it is to determine whether the child is abused or neglected. And if that is determined, then they're entitled to services. So the problem with the system we currently have is that we forget about the child and we focus on the alleged perpetrator. And when we do that, we do not provide the services the child's legally entitled to.
Well, that's certainly something that Marley and I have seen a lot of in our practice.
Right.
Well, this is all a lot of really helpful information, Christian, and we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and explain all of these things.
And that's a wrap of part two of our interview with Christian Green. Stay tuned for part three when we will discuss more about illegal third-party placement, per the directive, missing girls and missing documents. And we will be asking Christian questions that you've posed, as well as giving her some case studies to get her input on some situations that we've seen in the field. See you next time.